Thought Leadership from PwC.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of our series focused on climate reporting. This week, we're talking about a topic that's generated lots of questions: the role of carbon offsets and renewable energy credits within a net zero strategy, as well as accounting for these instruments and how they fit into the GHG reporting landscape.
I like to use what I call the RSIO framework: reduce, switch, innovate, offset, and largely in that order.
There's new strategies that we're hearing about almost every single day, and so there is a lot of opportunity just finding the right fit.
My guests today are Rich Good and Jillian Pierce. Rich is a PwC principal who focuses on helping companies evolve their ESG reporting, and he has a wealth of experience with the GHG protocol. If you missed them, check out his past two podcasts on Scope 1 and 2 GHG emissions, as well as Scope 3 GHG emissions. Jillian's a PwC National Office Partner and former SEC Fellow with extensive experience in the power and utilities industry, a sector that's right in the crosshairs of this conversation. Rich and Jillian together provide a lot of insight to help you cut through the noise around offsets and RECs. And no, they're not the same thing. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. All right, so Jillian, Rich, thanks so much for joining me today for a topic that I think is increasingly important to a number of companies, and that is the accounting and reporting for offsets and renewable energy credits. Now, before we get into the details, and just for our listeners' benefit, I'm planning to talk today about both the GHG reporting side and what's being proposed by the SEC, as well as we'll get into some accounting as well. But maybe before we get into that, just to level set, it might be helpful to actually talk about these instruments and what exactly they are. So Jillian, not to cut you off guard, but I'm going to go to you with that question. So maybe starting with sort of the spectrum, starting with renewable energy credits and then going to carbon offsets, can you explain some of the products that we're seeing out there?
Sure. Yeah. Happy to be here. So like you mentioned, there definitely is a spectrum. So on one end, you have things like RECs or renewable energy credits that represent 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy that is being produced. On the other end of the spectrum, you have carbon offsets that a lot of people refer to. And those actually refer to 1 ton of carbon that's being removed from the atmosphere. So sort of bookends. One is sort of the production of something green, and then the other end is the removal of actual emission or other gases from the atmosphere.
So Jillian, as we're thinking about them then, what are some of the, I'll say, key differences between the products that we see? And I know we'll get into this a little more when we talk about the accounting, but I still think it's helpful for people to kind of understand how they've grown up a little differently between those two products.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think sort of staying on that spectrum. So, you know, RECs have their origin really more from a compliance perspective. And so, you know, several years back, a lot of states introduced compliance programs that required the utilities in those areas to actually provide a certain percentage of the electricity to their customers from renewable energy sources. And so in order to comply with those regulations and standards, the utilities then had to procure the RECs to evidence that they were actually supplying their customers with that renewable or green energy. So that's sort of the beginning, I would say, and as we think about sort of the instruments that are out there today, RECs and those types of compliance instruments are definitely more mature. Moving forward now to the carbon offsets, you know, that's, I would say, more of the evolving space of instruments like this. And as opposed to the compliance side, a lot of times now we're seeing companies actually look to acquire carbon offsets purely from a voluntary perspective. So this is where you see a lot of the tie-in with companies making net zero or other carbon reduction goals and are looking to use carbon offsets as a means to achieve certain of those goals.
All right, Rich, anything from your perspective to add? I know you're dealing a lot with these instruments in the market.
I think Jillian said it perfectly. And just to add to one of the things she said, certainly lots more demand. And one of the things that our clients somewhat struggle with is that the price of these are not fixed. They're subject to the law of supply and demand, just like any other product. So when considering RECs and offsets as part of your strategy, it is really important to consider, well, what's the long-term impact here? If this is going to cost me X dollars today, could it cost me 10 times this next year? And the answer is yes, it could. So you have to really be careful about where you use RECs and offsets and how it fits as part of your overall ESG program.
And Rich, to that point, what you're talking about there is if I'm a company that is emitting and I say, okay, I can't reduce my emissions at the source. Maybe I've reduced them as much as I can. So instead, I'm going to offset them. That strategy may work in 2022, but as I look ahead, that may not be sustainable given the potential price of some of these products.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I like to use what I call the RSIO framework, reduce, switch, innovate, offset, and largely in that order, because reducing your energy and your energy use will reduce your carbon emissions, and then switching from high carbon to lower carbon technologies, innovation. That's the secret sauce that many companies are after. What do you do different than someone else that gives you that sustainable competitive advantage? That's what really ignites people's passions and fire about how can we make some real durable change here and get ahead of our competitors. And finally, offset at the end. What do you need to get over the goal line? Certainly, renewable energy credits can be a smaller investment than carbon offsets. But generally, what I do is I look at RECs and offsets as a really big pillar and component of any greenhouse gas reduction goal, but consider it in the context of the other three: reduce, switch, innovate, offset, because a lot of those pay rewards, meaning you reap financial benefits, whereas RECs and offsets, you don't necessarily reap financial benefits. You have to pay for them every year.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to some of the accounting. So I want to pause, though. Well, I have so many questions. Actually, let me rewind to a question I have for Jillian, and then I want to come back to your reduce, switch, innovate, offset. Jillian, when we talk about renewable energy, I think you and I both come from power utility sector and just presume everyone knows what renewable energy is. But can we just remind the audience, when we say renewable energy, what are generally some of the sources of renewable energy?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, probably the three main categories that most people are familiar with would be wind, so, you know, turbines, solar assets, and then hydro is the other sort of big bucket of, you know, general renewable energy that would generate the types of credits that we were talking about.
All right. And then how about, I know we sometimes see contracts, there's things like geothermal, biomass, there's a lot of these other types of sources. Do you tend to think about them differently, or it just depends if you're going to get that key REC if it's certified in the state?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, thermo, other biomass ones all would be sort of grouped together within the broader renewable energy umbrella. And then, like you said, it just comes down to, you know, the specific types of credits and certificates that are being produced from the different types of assets and processes.
All right. And then, Rich, I think this may go to your switch question. So let's actually start with that. When you say switch, what do you mean? What are you thinking about there?
A really easy example of switching from a high carbon to a low carbon activity would be video conference instead of business travel, right? That's an example. But there are others. There are a lot of processes that are fired by very high carbon sources, you know, very dirty, you know, diesel or bunker fuel, for example. It's called it's sort of a remnant of leftover from the refining process. And it does cost money to switch sometimes, but sometimes it can be such substantial environmental and financial benefits to doing that. Another example you're reading a lot about now is direct reduction of steel via hydrogen. Making steel is a very carbon-intensive process. It generally takes 2.5 tons of CO2 to make 1 ton of finished steel. However, instead of using coke to reduce steel, you can use hydrogen. That's a burgeoning technology. There's still a lot to be ironed out, but there are several companies that have committed to have 100% green steel in the near future. So it's definitely a growing technology, and another good example of how Switch can actually help give a company a sustainable competitive advantage.
It's interesting because, again, coming from power and utilities background, when I was thinking Switch, I was thinking switching fuel sources. So I'm generating power. Instead of doing coal, I'm going to generate from natural gas. Maybe I'll actually site some nuclear plants now, right? Because that's a low carbon source. Obviously, some other questions with nuclear. So there's all different spots, right? But again, I guess to your point, that would be the utility itself. And then that's maybe would help companies with their scope 2 emissions, which we'll get to in a moment. So Rich, let's just make sure we run through all four of these. So we talked about reduce, we talked about innovate, or we talked about switch. Now let's talk about innovate. Again, just a few key examples there.
Yeah, innovation is really one of those things that it speaks to a company's secret sauce. How can I make my product more environmentally friendly? Let's use automobiles as an example. A major U.S. automotive company here switched to a steel. They designed their vehicle to use a different steel, which had a much higher strength to weight ratio. So they advertised in their portfolio that each of their vehicles had went on a diet, if you will, and lost about 700 pounds. So having a car that weighs 700 pounds less than another competing car, that was a great innovation. It still met the crash test criteria. Mm-hmm. It was still a five-star safety rated vehicles, but moving 700 pounds of metal down the road requires a lot less energy. So that there's a good example that they were able to turn that innovation into something that really resonated with their customers buying their vehicles.
All right. So then let's go to actually into some of the reporting, which is on GHG. And specifically, before we get into where RECs and offsets fit in, Rich, I'm going to have you level set once again for the different types of emissions. I know you've said this the past couple of podcasts, but what are the three types of scope of emissions that we talk about?
Sure. Greenhouse gas emissions are generally categorized into three broad categories. Scope one are direct emissions, direct fossil fuel burning. So an example, think of your home. If you turn on the heat at night and it's powered by oil or natural gas, that's scope one emissions. You're using the fossil fuel to heat your home or drive your vehicle. Scope two is purchased electricity. There are also some other parts of scope two, like purchased steam and purchased chilled water. They're less common, but it's also part of scope two. Scope three is really everything else. Supply chain or value chain emissions. There are 15 different categories, but generally they break up into two. Upstream categories, and that's everything that goes into making your product. And then from the time your product leaves your facility and goes downstream to your customers, that's downstream emissions. And there are 15 categories. Not all 15 apply to all companies, but it's good to know and get that level set that there are 15 categories there.
Yeah, but you can look at the greenhouse gas protocol if you want more information on those categories. I would recommend that anyway, if you're starting to deal with these products, even if you're not on the GHG reporting side. But so Rich, with that level setting then, how do offsets and RECs fit in as we think about these different scopes?
The important thing, what Jillian said in the very beginning, a REC is an instrument that shows that 1 megawatt of clean, renewable energy has been produced. If you're going to purchase a REC, renewable energy credit, it can only be used to offset electricity. And it sort of makes sense. If the certificate itself states that it only offsets electricity purchases, then it should only be used to offset scope two. So I'll just say that again. RECs are only used to offset scope two emissions. Carbon offsets have a broader applicability, and they have a different sort of unit. Carbon offsets don't talk about megawatts of electricity. They talk about tons of carbon. So a carbon offset says a ton of carbon has been avoided or removed from the atmosphere. It has different criteria, different certifications. They tend to be more expensive than RECs. And you're able to use them across all three scopes, scope one, two, and three. Don't really recommend using them for scope two because RECs are a far more financially attractive solution for reducing scope two. But offsets can be used for scope one and scope three.
All right. So then, Jillian, maybe going back to you, as we think about the SEC climate proposal and actually greenhouse gas protocol, how do we think about the actual reporting then in terms of how we are reporting scope 1, 2, and 3, and then how we report the RECs and offsets?
Right. So the proposals and sort of the reporting rules require that a company's emissions are reported on a gross basis. So you're going to start with your total emissions in each of the three scopes that Rich talked about. And then to the extent that a company is using offsets or RECs or other instruments, those would be reported separately. And, you know, part of the intent, I think, in that gross reporting is really to provide visibility into the different pillars that Rich talked about that a company is, you know, using in their environmental strategy. So, you know, are they actually changing their business processes from one period to the next and, you know, reducing their emissions, innovating to find new ways to, you know, provide their products or services, or are they really relying on offsets or RECs? And I think that's important. We particularly see it come through in the SEC proposal from an investor perspective to have visibility into the company's current strategies and then potentially, like Rich highlighted, how some of those strategies may result in, you know, risk in future periods.
Let me ask a follow-up question then, because what's interesting to me, and obviously, Jillian talked about gross versus net reporting, but the SEC climate proposal and the greenhouse gas protocol both explicitly, use the word allow, the use of offsets in terms of showing a reduction in emissions. However, if we look at the Science-Based Targets Initiative, which many of our listeners may be familiar with, it's a way of setting net zero or other emissions targets that's fairly widely used. And if you're not familiar and you're getting into this field, it's another good thing to look into a bit. That the SBTI permits the use of RECs, but it does not allow the use of offsets in reducing emissions. And so, Rich, can you explain why they're thinking about it that way?
Well, I wasn't there when they made the decision. But
well, you can speculate.
my crystal ball for this one.
Yes.
I think it's in response to the issue of paying your way out of a problem. RECs and offsets are often seen as just for more wealthy companies to just write a check and say, I'm net zero. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't really believe or agree with that stance wholeheartedly. Offsets in particular often have societal co-benefits. That's why offsets are more expensive. You have to have this thing called additionality, meaning the project wouldn't happen unless you funded it. And some of these projects are designed to really assist people in developing countries that could use the help. Different solar-powered cook stoves is a good example, a very famous example, where companies buying carbon offsets demonstrably improve the life of people in developing nations. So there are some societal co-benefits, but I do believe it's sort of seen as, well, let's not buy your way out of a problem. Also, very large companies often have the ability to affect change in their supply chain far greater than they feel. When Scope 3 emissions first came out, a lot of companies just said, well, I'll calculate it, but there's no way I can reduce it because mm-hmm. I'm not responsible for those emissions whatsoever. But many big companies have since found that they can use their power, their leverage, for assisting their suppliers in reducing their own emissions. So you're seeing more and more, and we even see it here at PwC, we'll receive an RFP from a client, and before you even get into your response, they want to know whether you have a sustainability report, do you calculate your greenhouse gas emissions, do you reduce them, what's your environmental commitment, and you can't even bid on the project unless you provide those things. That's an example of driving change within the supply chain, and I believe that's what the SBT is getting at. Don't just count your scope 3 and leave it there. There are measures you can take holistically to reduce them.
All right. I think that's helpful. And I do think, Rich, you touched on a much, much broader question that we're not going to delve into in this podcast, but it's really sort of the philosophy here in terms of how, quote unquote, should we as a society or the planet reduce emissions and what are all the different ways. But I think, again, here we're going to stick to the actual reporting of those. And, you know, that, like I said, that's probably a much broader question for another podcast. So with that said, why don't we talk a little bit about the markets, Rich? And in particular, I think Jillian did a good job explaining upfront where RECs come from. They're highly regulated. And, you know, this is something that I think if we were even go back 15 years is probably when we first really started seeing this product of RECs and the true separation of what we would call the brown power from the green power and the fact that you can buy that separately. But offsets are much newer and they're much less standard. So where are companies getting these offsets?
Sure. There are brokers, third parties that sell offsets, and many of them are very reputable. So I would be careful where you buy them. You know, I wouldn't buy them off of somebody in a back alley also selling selling speakers that fell off a truck. But looking for reputable sources. But the other thing to look for is the validation of the verification of the offset. You know, just one example. There was a company selling carbon offsets for a particular forest in South America. And they had attributes every year. So you buy these offsets every year, talking about the carbon that was absorbed in the atmosphere from this forest. However, upon closer inspection, the forest had actually been burnt down. So it wasn't there anymore. So now it's not the company who bought them. It's not their mm-hmm. fault. It's not even mm-hmm. the company they bought them from fault, because they were valid when they sold them. But there are ongoing validation and verification responsibilities, audits, if you will, to show that the benefits that you're proposing actually happen.
Well, and I think, Rich, that goes to a question of timing and what exactly is it that you're buying and when should those be recognized? All right. So, Rich, as we're thinking about our offsets, you talked about the additionality and you also talked about making sure it's trusted source, does exist, et cetera. But one thing that was interesting with the example you gave is if someone had audited that forest, they would have realized that the forest was no longer there. So how do companies think about auditability of these offsets? What are you sort of looking for?
Looking for who did the audit. The gold standard in carbon offsets is called the gold standard. and it's a collaboration between the World Wildlife Fund and the United Nations. And they have boots on the ground in these developing countries that go and validate and verify that, is this forest still standing? Is this joint implementation? Is this conversion plant still operating? And there are different sort of standards. And that goes back to what I said earlier about being careful about how you use offsets. Make sure they come from a reputable source. And are audited at least once with periodic check-ins. And there's no better way, I think, than having local boots on the ground. The UN works with developing countries. They're actually employing people to do this work. And it gives that comfort level that I'm buying something real and durable that also has these societal co-benefits.
All right. So with all of that background, then, as I said, we're going to come back to the GHG reporting. But Jillian, let me pull you back into the conversation and let's jump to the accounting. Because putting aside GHG reporting, if you are buying RECs and offsets, now you have some accounting you need to do. So how do we think about the accounting for these instruments?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think companies that are buying and selling these instruments, like you said, have to figure out, what do I do with them now, right? And, you know, I think, unfortunately, there's no explicit accounting guidance, either domestically from a U.S. GAAP perspective or even globally. We don't have a standard, so it's not as easy as going to look up to see, like, okay, what is the accounting model for a carbon offset? That might come one day in the future, but as of now, it doesn't exist. So because of that, in practice, a lot of companies have looked to either an inventory or an intangible model for accounting for things like carbon offsets.
All right. You just mentioned we don't have a model, but we do have potentially good news on this front, right? With the FASB agreeing to take on a project. Can you give a little more information on that?
Right. So the FASB board actually just recently decided to add a new project onto their technical agenda to address these specific types of instruments. So renewable energy credits, carbon offsets, and other sort of environmental attributes. And the project's really going to look at it holistically. So from the perspective of companies that may be involved in generating these types of products, as well as entities that are purchasing offsets or RECs. And it's also going to look at both the voluntary programs as well as the mandatory or the compliance programs that we talked a little bit about earlier. So again, really, at least initially, they're planning to address all aspects of these. But like I said, the decision was just made very recently. So still early stages, but you know, at least that's a positive step, hopefully, towards providing a consistent model.
Well, and I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about these models, and it's definitely not easy. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for them to work through, I do know there's some accepted practice in terms of how companies are accounting for them. And you did mention inventory and intangibles. So let's put that on, say, okay, we've said these are inventory or intangibles. Sort of what comes next? What are some of the things companies should be thinking about?
Yeah, so those are the two models that we've seen companies apply in practice. So again, that's sort of decision one is, you know, which model does the company want to apply? And then once you're in that model, some of the things to think about is sort of what does a day two accounting look like? So things like impairment, right? If you're in an inventory model, generally that's going to be evaluated from a lower of cost or net realizable value perspective. So you'd have to be thinking about sort of that analysis. As opposed to if you're in an intangible model, there the first step is, do I have a definite or an indefinite lived intangible? So again, you'd have to understand the specifics of, you know, your products and programs. And then from there, what does that respective impairment model look like? If you're a definite lived intangible, then you're going to be following the 360 impairment model. Whereas if you're an indefinite lived intangible, then you're going to be following the impairment model under ASC 350. So more things like goodwill, that type of evaluation. So again, could be more complexity and multiple questions maybe perhaps to think about depending on which model you start in.
All right. And if we stay focused on companies that are voluntarily buying offsets, I know some of the points that Rich made earlier in terms of reliability and some of the trustworthiness of the offsets may go to measurement. So how do you think about some of those items?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I think that gets into sort of the day two accounting, right? And how you think about that. I think, you know, both the inventory and the intangible are really cost-based models. So in most cases, if a company's purchasing an offset, they're going to recognize that asset based on the cost that they paid. They're not a fair value model. So again, even though Rich mentioned that, you know, market values for these types of things likely do move all over the place, you know, neither the inventory nor the intangible model would really allow you to reflect those changes in fair value. So, you know, typically you'd start at cost and then you'd have to evaluate for impairment. And that would be, you know, really the only point in time under either of those models where you would, you know, record an adjustment to the value of the assets.
Right. Although fair point that Rich made that potentially these could be derivatives, although I think right now, typically we don't see these accounted for as derivatives, but it's definitely something that we're keeping an eye on. So Jillian, let me jump ahead then, because one of the questions we always get is, okay, I just bought this offset and I'm planning to use it to offset my emissions this month. And so my view, I don't really have anything anymore. I just want expense it right away. Is that how you would typically think about it?
So generally, that's not how we would think about it from an accounting perspective. Although to be fair, I think that is a lot of companies and, you know, people's initial reaction for maybe how they would think about, you know, how these types of products are being used. But generally, we look to the point in time when the company actually retires or turns in the offset as being the trigger for the entity to derecognize that asset. So we talked about sort of the process that, you know, the offsets go through to be validated and registered. And then it's really not until the company, again, turns that in, surrenders it back to sort of the governing body to say that they've actually used it, can claim it for, you know, purposes of, at least for reporting, reducing their emissions. And at that point in time, then it's effectively taken out of circulation so that no other entity can use that same offset in the future.
And I guess, Jillian, I think this is a really key point. Why is that? Because if I'm saying, hey, look, I'm using it, and I'm putting that using in quotes, I'm using it to offset my emissions, I don't plan to sell it, why can't I just expense it?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And really the key is, until you actually do something with it, you still have the ability to sell it. So, you know, again, we were talking about different strategies that companies could employ. And so how a company plans to use an offset today may be different than how they ultimately use it 1, 2, 3 years down the road, depending on some of the other, you know, business decisions that they've made. And so that's really the basis for why, from an accounting perspective, we would really look at sort of when they lose control, turn it in, as the point that, you know, they won't no longer have the ability to do anything with that asset.
Okay,
they
so made true abandonment. Yeah, so truly abandoning it. And then what if I decide I actually do change my mind and I do sell it? What do I do at that point?
Yeah, so, you know, again, I think that's the reality, right? Like Rich said, there are markets for these things. So absolutely, companies can be and are selling these. So then again, depending on which model, inventory or intangible you're under, once you sell the asset, then you'd have to determine, you know, what cost to recognize as an expense during that period of time, depending on, you know, the costing methodology that you've used under either of those models.
All right. And then Jillian, I know this is something that we've spent hours and hours and probably reams of paper, which is not too environmentally friendly, so maybe reams of computer type, talking about and writing about. So I'm asking you to summarize this in, you know, just a few minutes. But any other sort of tricky points you'd at least highlight for companies to think about?
I guess a couple things. You know, one important point I would say is, as companies are thinking about sort of which accounting model to use, I would make sure you're thinking about sort of the full implications. So things like presentation, not only from a balance sheet perspective, but also income statement presentation and also cash flow presentation, because between inventory and intangibles, oftentimes that activity will be presented differently. Inventory typically from an operating cash flow perspective and intangible typically in investing. And those are some of the decisions that we oftentimes find companies maybe don't think about upfront. So that would be maybe one of the other key points just to think about, to understand as companies are developing some of their accounting policies for these items.
So Jillian, it's very helpful background. And I do think it's important to get this accounting right, to really think about it and make these elections and to make sure that you have a plan for the accounting. But Rich, let me come back to you, because to the earlier point of our conversation, the reason companies are voluntarily buying them is to show a reduction, you know, as they're doing their GHG reporting. And so how do you think about when to report these items in your GHG reports?
Sure. One of the important parts of a REC is that it be retired. You know, we've seen examples of companies that create RECs, take credit for them, and then sell them. You know, that's not only incorrect accounting, it borders on fraud. Occasionally, if you're working with a broker in this market, you can find really good deals, frankly, that might have a bunch that came on the market and you're able to secure more than enough for this year. Whatever you use in that reporting year should then be retired. And by retired, you know, there's a special process you go through. But essentially, it's the electronic equivalent of tearing it up and throwing it in the trash, never to be used again. Focusing on what you use that year and properly retiring that rec is really sort of the way you're supposed to do it.
All right. And I think what I like about this is it's a place where the accounting and the GHG reporting clearly are perfectly aligned, because Rich and Jillian just made the exact same point, which is that you have an asset that you haven't used until you actually do abandon, retire, whatever the right word is. So I think it's very key. There's a whole cycle here, and we can't just stop halfway through the cycle, but we have to take it all the way through to that close and abandonment. So Rich, the other sort of final question I have for you before we get to wrap up, we touched on before, but I think now that we've had the conversation, I think it might be more meaningful to people, is if I'm thinking about this from a business perspective. So our listeners are mostly the accountants and the people responsible for the reporting, maybe GHG or the accounting reporting, but they're obviously participating in discussions in their companies about sort of strategy. And so I'm a company, I've said I'm going to be net zero, and yet their only thing they're doing is offsets. What do you see sort of the risks that that company is going to have in the future?
Sure. That's a good question, Heather. And what I had mentioned earlier, the RSIO, reduce, switch, innovate, offset. I think just by focusing on the last piece, the offset, is leaving a lot of opportunity on the table. And I say that because investments in energy efficiency return the investment quickly. Look, even if it's 2 or 3 years, offsets and RECs don't necessarily have any return at all. They're expenses. Now, they're a good and integral part of any greenhouse gas reduction strategy. They're doing societal co-benefits, especially when you're talking about offsets, and they help subsidize the installation of more renewable energy, which are things we need. Those are all good things, but they don't necessarily pay a financial return. So focusing on reducing your own energy consumption, switching high carbon activities to low carbon activities, and really unleashing your workforce on the innovation component. How really ESG is something for has something for everybody in an organization, particularly with these new regulations. It's not just, you know, that 5% of the CEO's pay is tied to achieving a greenhouse gas reduction goal. What about the person in shipping or the person who's a facility manager? Just accurately reporting greenhouse energy consumption. That's probably not part of their job description. Making sure it's there and unleashing that talent that you have in all across the workforce to bring these ideas. They pay benefits and they also engage your workforce. We're still in the midst of the great resignation and hiring challenges. Wouldn't you want to do something that energizes and engages your workforce rather than just sort of saying, well, we're just going to write a check to reduce our emissions?
All right. I definitely like that point. I almost want to end on it, but I do have one final question for both of you. And one of the things I really enjoyed about this conversation is that you are talking about the same instruments, but coming at it from a different perspective, as I said, because Jillian is focused on the financial statement reporting and Rich, you've been mostly focused on GHG reporting. So as you think about the broad spectrum, or if you want to focus on your own part, what's a piece of advice you give to companies specific to dealing with RECs and offsets, sort of put aside from your broader GHG reporting, or obviously, Jillian, your broader accounting considerations? So Jillian, I'll start with you first.
I would say really just continue to learn what's out there and understand the types of programs. You know, I think at least from what I've been seeing, there's new strategies that we're hearing about almost every single day. And so I think, like Rich mentioned just at the end, right, there is a lot of opportunity. And so I think as much as companies can learn sort of what's on the landscape and, you know, what may make sense for their respective company to engage in, that's what I would say, because I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. It's just finding the right fit.
Well, and I think, Jillian, to that point, you can't really do your accounting if you don't understand the instruments you're dealing with. And so even just understanding your own programs and then understanding how they fit into the broader landscape, I 100% agree with you. And then Rich, as we transition from accounting to GHG reporting, how do you think about these? What advice do you have?
Heather, I can't help but think about one of the best life lessons I ever had, which is being deliberate. There's 3 ways to make a decision. You can say yes, you can say no, or you can say nothing at all. If you say nothing at all, someone else makes that decision for you. So my advice is to be deliberate. Understand, as Jillian says, what RECs and offsets are, and then make a deliberate decision on how they're to be used in managing and mitigating your greenhouse gas emissions.
All right, great advice. And I love that those 2 pieces of advice really do fit together, just like this conversation today. So Jillian, Rich, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure as always, Heather.
Thanks, Heather.
That does it for today. Join me back here next week for new podcast episodes. On Tuesday, we're launching a new toolkit series, this month focused on leases. This series will have some helpful information for private companies that are in their year of implementation for ASC 842, and we'll also go through some of the common and most difficult questions that we hear from clients on this topic. And on Thursday, we're continuing our look at the SEC's recent proposals with a focus on governance. So that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all the latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.